We'll try to be better now.
No, we won't. No, we won't. This is about as good as it gets. And if you're watching this, you already knew that. Welcome to everything we're going to do.
I really feel like we should have let Megan start us out here because this is her book.
Oh, no, that's fine.
Should we try that?
I don't want to be in charge.
You don't want to be in charge?
No.
Because you're going to be in charge.
I just want to bask in the glow of you all telling me how good this book was. You introduce more things.
Okay, I'll introduce more things and then we'll go to your basking.
I will bask.
Yeah. We are the blue team. Of you made, positive.
No, I am not.
Now I know how Craig feels. Some of you probably have not seen us very much. We haven't done anything as the blue team for a little while. So it's really fun to get back together doing a science fiction book recommended by Megan. It was on my list and she's like, I don't know if you guys want to do this book. And I'm like, I want to do this book. I just wait for a chance to do it. So we are doing Hail Mary. Project Hail Mary. And we are, if you've been around here, you know all the things. Catch us on the legendariumpodcast.com. Catch us on Discord. You're watching us on YouTube if you're watching this. If you're not watching this, what are you doing?
Catch us on the flippity flap, whatever.
This is kind of us. Yeah, this is who we are. Wait a minute.
We are not chill.
Before we do this, I just want to tell you guys how glad I am that we're doing this.
I know. This is nice. It's been a long, long time.
Somebody asked me the other day, they said, so was the pandemic really hard for you? I mean, hard for me. I said, there were things about the pandemic that were hard, but the one thing that was not hard was I had my podcast team that I was working with and that got me through.
Yeah.
You guys are the best.
Aww.
So thank you.
We're the best.
Takes one to know one.
Yeah. Well,
right back at you.
I know you are, but what am I? Yeah.
Infinity.
I'm rubber and you're good.
No, we're not going to go there. You are. Let's just go with that.
Yeah, we all are.
Let's go
with that. All right. We're going
blue
with that.
Blue team forever. All right.
Blue team. Yay.
Ken, do you have a recap for us?
Would it be a blue team episode if I didn't?
I will say Ken did ask if I wanted to do the recap. And I was like, oh, that's so nice. Mine are terrible. You do it, Ken.
Yours are not so
terrible. I love Ken's recaps. It's been a long time.
Let's see.
Maybe that's the last time I say it's been a long time.
And maybe that's the last time that we say they're so wonderful. Let's see what he gives
us
this
time. That might be the last time you say you like my recap.
I know. What if he hated it?
He's kind of out of practice, too. His last one.
Whatever. It was dynamite. You guys didn't hear my great Game of Thrones recap.
No,
not yet,
maybe
but it's
I
in
want
my queue.
To. Maybe after I'll listen to that.
Yeah. Listen to that. Okay. But first listen to this.
Yeah.
Okay.
I have few rules in life. Yeah. But that already, Todd?
No, just keep talking, Ken.
Among those rules is if you wake up in a sci-fi escape room next to two dead bodies with no idea who you are and no clue of how you got there, just roll with it. It's fine. Such is the case in Project Hail Mary, which focuses around a guy who's been set on a wild course to save the world from extinction thanks to a series of unfortunate clerical errors.
I love that!
I don't know what that means. Keep going.
Keep going.
I like you guys. You guys are all right. Like a puppy finding that perfect sunspot on the living room rug, there's some weird alien goo nestling itself comfortably in the sweet spot between the sun and earth. Only one minor inconvenient issue, it's slowly and then quickly blotting out the sun, threatening a new global ice age. Who better to solve this issue than one lazy, single, marginally competent scientist? Yay.
Junior high school science teacher.
Because in the most critical extinction level event in the history of the world, clearly we're going to leave the fate of the world into one unfulfilled and marginally smart junior high school science teacher. Sure. Sure. Makes sense.
He knows a lot of things I don't know.
That's true.
I still don't.
I still love it.
Yeah. So after being strong armed by the great, great, great grandmother of Christian Avasarala, he picks. Todd.
We will talk about that.
Yeah.
Okay.
And Megan's like, I didn't read The Expanse.
Don't plan to.
Oh my goodness.
Okay, that's
okay. Great, great grandmother of Christian Avasarala. He packs his favorite junior high school science teacher's Run the World t-shirt and off he goes to Tau Ceti, where this goo likely came from. Unfortunately, his entire crew dies en route. Very fortunately, someone has already beaten him there, and they have the same problem. This guy's a riot, I guess. So, like, he's kind of like a giant rock spider engineer. Somehow they make contact, learn to communicate, and then, filled with all the esoteric detail and depth befitting the glorified writing exercise of a very smart guy who really wants to flex his smarty pants, off they go to save the worlds. Because both worlds, you know. Mm-hmm. Bottom line, they find the solution. They say their goodbyes. They go their separate ways. I'm skipping over some stuff here. And then Dummy gonna do dummy things. He never makes it home because he turns around. I just stopped after that. I'm like, no.
What?
I will say it is quite like the whole thing where he's like, oh, no. Well, we're saved. Oh, no. Here's the problem. And I was just kind of like, it kept going too long.
Just, yeah, you went.
Get there faster.
You went too far. And I'm kind of glad because we really didn't want him bringing that into the gene pool when he gets home. I'm just done with him. No. So, all right. So here's your first question. Save these for the.
Okay.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
So did he make the right choice? First question. Easy question. Number two, if you're on a 4-year trip and you have a year's worth of coma slurry to eat and only months of real food available, wouldn't you save and ration some of that real food and try to subsist on slurry as much as you can?
I would. I'm just saying.
And you're on a 4-year trip with unlimited video games. What's the first thing you're playing?
Those are a lot more cheerful
than the questions I came up with.
Well, we'll get to.
I have a couple.
We'll get to those questions. Okay. I try not to bring like the serious questions in, you know, because that's boring. Hindsight Grace.
Did you just say Todd's boring?
No, I said that's. Oh, that's okay. That's boring. Well, Todd's great.
You may as well have said that.
Whoa.
It's true.
All right. Those bottom line, Grace is really annoying and then imminently hateable and punchable, but at least he saves the rest of us, I guess. So there's that. Yay. Go blue team. Go.
Go blue team.
Go blue team.
Yay.
Sorry. I wanted to have a punchy, you know, outro, but I just.
I love it. Yeah. I think go blue team is great. Yeah, just, you know, it's kind of like Thunderbirds.
Go team.
But we're blue team. Megan, this was not your first rodeo in this book. Yes.
No. I thought I had read it two other times because I read it again this week, like really fast. But I've read it one other time and it's just a book that stays with me. I think about it often. I think about his relationship with Rocky and because, you know me, I don't always care about the science necessarily. But if there are characters I care about and good relationships and a decent story, I'm in. I'm willing to go with it. This one did go a little bit too long. But I think it's very cool the way the story reveals itself, where he doesn't remember anything at the beginning. He doesn't know what's going on, but he's like, oh, hey, I can do science. Oh, hey, here's this stuff. Let's just do it. And you find out about him and the process of how he got there and why he's there just really slowly. And then it's interesting where they tell you, like, he ended up getting onto this ship kicking and screaming. And how soon after that he realizes that Rocky's ship is doomed and he makes a sacrifice play.
Yeah.
Like, well, I care about Rocky. I'm going to save he didn't really have anybody he cared about specifically on Earth. He kind of claimed that he cared about his students, which is probably true, but it's not the same. Where he had spent so much time with his one friend. He said, like, I didn't really have any friends. I didn't really have anybody I care about. He was mostly just a really cowardly person who ends up making the sacrifice play and growing as a human, which I like those kind of stories. And it came about organically. Like, I believed that he did actually make that choice, even though, like, he didn't have to. Nobody would have known except for him.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, I love the story. I just think it's really well told.
Okay. Good. Ken. I mean, we got your recap, but what do you think?
It was fine.
I accept that.
I don't know how much by the middle of the book, I was trying to decide how much I really didn't like this book and how much I just wanted to play the contrarian and say I didn't like this book.
Fair.
Oh, okay.
Meaning I found it was interesting. Andy Weir gets a lot of play in smart people circles or what people think smart people circles are supposed to be, like Andy Weir is so brilliant, blah, blah, blah.
Science guy saves the world as they will.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and he's great. Don't get me wrong. But I went into it thinking, you know, Andy Weir's amazing. And I was like, This is, it really is. He's a brilliant tech mind who decided, I want to try writing. And his writing feels like it's somebody whose primary job is not writing.
Let me ask this, sure. Ken. Did you read it or did you listen to it?
I listened to it.
Okay.
And I also read it. Well, I mean, I kind of like concurrently, so I didn't full on read it. But okay. I listened to it. And by the way, the narrator, monumentally annoying.
Oh, really?
Sorry, Meg.
Fair.
Wow, I loved it.
I didn't like him quite so much. Okay. I mean, he was a good narrator. As narrators go, he was a good narrator. Maybe I just didn't like the way he brought this story to life for me. I went from thinking Grace was fine to thinking he was annoying to really finding him eminently punchable.
Sure.
By the end.
Which I think is consistent with the characterization that they had put together for him of who he was before he left.
Maybe.
So while I don't know if Andy intended it that way, Mr. Weir, do we have to call him Mr. Weir?
No,
Can I call him Andy?
We have a first name basis on all of our hosts, okay. Or on all, okay, of our authors.
Just,
yeah.
Just checking. You've
met some of the authors and they were not offended when you called them by their
first name. That's true.
That is true.
Yeah.
That is true. So,
and from what everything I hear, Andy Weir is a cool dude.
I'm sure he is.
Yeah. Down to earth type. Yeah. You know,
until otherwise, I will believe that everybody is, except for a certain few individuals who will remain unnamed on this podcast. Talk about them afterwards.
Okay. Yeah. I want to hear that afterwards.
Oh, yeah. It's a lot of fun. Anyway, I think Andy's approach to all of this is whether Andy approached it from the standpoint of saying, I want people to like this guy and then hate this guy the same way that everybody else on the planet hated him before. Yeah. And so I'm going to write that as part of the arc. Or if it just happened for you, I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
How do you feel, maybe this is too soon in this podcast episode to ask this question, but how do you feel about Ryan Gosling potentially playing this character in a movie version? Because that's in development.
Ryan Gosling is eminently punchable.
Yeah.
Wow.
Oh, wow. Do you not agree with me on that one?
I kind of like Ryan Gosling.
I mean,
I'm not saying like Ryan Gosling is like the coolest guy ever, but I never have had a problem with Ryan Gosling.
I don't have a problem with him. I just think he's eminently punchable.
Okay.
His face screams to be punched.
Wow.
Not because it has been punched, but because he just has this look.
You got Megan rolling right there.
I mean, this is the Ryan Gosling look.
You're not wrong.
He tries to smolder everything. And that's like, if somebody's going to try and smolder everything, that deserves to be punched.
You got
to
have an actual smolder. You can't just like try to smolder.
And I like him as an actor. And I like the stuff that he's done. I am so looking forward. This episode is being recorded in advance of the Fall Guy movie.
I'm very excited for
that. That looks so much fun.
It looks great.
And every time I watch that, I'm like, and it's just going to be Ryan Gosling getting punched all the time. I am going to enjoy this film a lot. Well, so
yeah, I think part of the problem with the character of Rylan Grace is that we are getting it from his perspective.
Yeah.
And so we're getting absolutely every whiny thought, like every, oh, poor me. What? You guys think I'm having a relationship with Strat? What? You think I'm second? Like he panics about everything, which is unfortunate. But I also, kind of to your point, Ken, where it's like it's written as a story, but it's like, what is the point of this story? I kind of want to know who he's talking to. Like it would have been more interesting for me if he had been recording this as something to send with the Beatles back to Earth. If this is the experience that I had.
Ooh, that would have been.
And this is how I remember this. And this is, oh my gosh, I didn't realize. Or if he's recording this as a series of logs.
Yeah.
Daily logs, because he is a scientist. They generally record their information, and he makes a point of, I could never find any paper, so I'm just writing on the walls or my arm.
That is very interesting.
But yeah, like because we're all getting it in first person, and I'm sorry, I'm going to bring up Twilight, but I think that's part of the reason why people hate Twilight so much is we're getting it from the point of view of a 17-year-old girl, and 17-year-old girls are not always the most likable people. And at least, you know, in their brains, they think they're amazing. But it's kind of the same with him where he's like, I'm really knowledgeable. I'm a really good guy. But also, I don't have any friends. Why is that? No, I choose not to.
No, they choose not to.
Right. Yeah. It's a little bit of both.
Well, and I think we get a glimpse of that fairly early on. Mm-hmm. When we get to the part where they were talking about, okay, before we get into that, I need to pause this.
Did you just speak in Rocky language? I have plenty of friends who are 17-year-old girls who I love, but I don't want to read their journals. Anyway, continue.
Yeah,
exactly. I'm glad you said that rather than me.
Yes.
So
same.
I have lived with 17-year-old girls. My daughters.
Yeah, daughters are difficult.
Yeah. So anyway, one of the things that happens kind of early on is we get this. It happens all the way through. We get huge info dumps about scientific stuff.
Yeah.
How?
And I feel like that's Andy Weir flexing his smarty pants.
I totally agree.
That is him going, I know science and I'm going to show you.
So now here's my question. Obviously, Ken, I think I'm going to make an assumption that was not necessarily a good thing for you.
It wasn't necessarily a bad thing for me, though, honestly. I mean, you go into a science book or science fiction book expecting the science in science fiction. That wasn't the problem for me. But some of it became a little bit like, all right, an actual writer, and I want to couch between being a
non-scientist writer.
Yeah. We'll say that I'm trying to couch between being a critic and being just an observer, like somebody who likes science fiction, because I mean, clearly this is not Andy Weir's first rodeo. He is clearly a science fiction author.
Yes, right. He is.
And a good one. He's written a lot of stuff.
Well,
and
we
the
know
Martian
that in science
fantastic.
Fiction, the science is supposed to drive the narrative, which it 1,000% does. In
right.
Book.
Yes.
But
it does.
This feels like the science is driving the fiction and then kind of like weaving the fiction back and forth on the road and then like stopping at the rest stop and like getting a soda and it stops driving.
Yeah. Nothing kills a story like too much exposition.
Or like it gets, you know, bogged down in looking out the window and all of a sudden the speed drops or something, you know? So the science is driving the story, but it keeps getting distracted. I don't know. So,
and I listen to you saying that and I say to myself, Ken, you are absolutely wrong.
Okay.
This is one of those moments where I feel very much like Craig. Oh. Ken, you are wrong.
Elaborate, please.
I was in my element. I grinned through this whole book. Whether it was the hard science exposition about the piece where he was talking about astrophage being and a proof of the theorem that he had written and the paper that he had written years ago that all life didn't have to be based on water and astrophage proves it and all this kind of stuff. And then they break through and he's like, oh, shit.
And then almost immediately,
sorry. It is water on the inside. And I'm like,
dang it.
Not only do I know what it feels like to publish some of those papers, I also know what it feels like when everybody looks at you and says, you're wrong. And then you're right. And then you're wrong again. So there were pieces of the academic side. There were pieces of the science side that I was just at home. I was happy as a pig in slop, if you want to put it that way, but a very mathed up pig. This is one of the first times that our hard science fiction stuff really was satisfying to me.
Mm-hmm.
I loved it.
Okay. Maybe we need to read The Martian then, because I talked with a friend of mine. I haven't read any other of Andy Weir's novels, but I talked with a friend of mine who said that he had read The Martian and really enjoyed that one. He's like, it's a similar narrative where it's like, you know, science guy goes to space, saves the world. Woo. I saw the movie. I enjoyed it. But he said Matt Damon.
Matt Damon does not have a punchable face. Just saying. Just saying.
Megan with 10 degrees free, it sounds
depends
like.
On the role.
He gets his face punched a lot.
Yeah, true. But for my friend, he said that he felt like the science in The Martian was super well researched and all held up. And he felt like it didn't necessarily hold up as much in Project Hail Mary. And I re-listened to Project Hail Mary after hearing my friend make this comment. And I listened and I was like, I mean, I'm not that sciencey, but it all seemed to make sense for me, but I wasn't scrutinizing it. I was listening to it as a narrative device.
Yeah.
And not necessarily as a, like, this is not a scientific paper. This is just him, like, here's all of this really cool stuff. And here's a whole bunch of hypothesizing. And here's some stuff I'm making up.
Well, and that's that is the one place is that when we start dealing with the physics and the science of astrophage, now it's all made up. And when we start dealing with some of Rocky's science, again, we're looking at some things that are highly conjectured and very made up.
It's logical. It sounds logical in the story. And that's about as far as I want to look into it, personally.
It's plausible.
Yeah.
Right. We'll call it
plausible. And
I'm like, that sounds good.
I found it really fascinating. Satisfying.
It's very spec fiction.
Yes.
So this is all of the science when he gets to Tau Ceti and everything there is very speculative because it's all stuff that is just made up, but it
can't be proved.
Yeah. But
as we know,
he's got a great science foundation so he can make these things sound good. And that's great. Okay. In a science fiction story, that is everything you want. And I like how there were several, not inconsistencies in writing, but inconsistencies in the science between the Iridian science and the human science in things like
Xenonite.
Things like Xenonite, which this is a tangent. Imagine that. Some of the naming conventions in this book, I hated them. Like Xenonite, really? You can't call it Xenite? Just like cut out a syllable there. Taumiba. Really? These are the names we're going with, Andy? Come on.
Oh, and see, I would probably get yelled at this, but I'm like, but he's a science guy. He's not a language guy. Like even Grace at one point goes, man, it's exhausting having to name new things all the time.
It's
so
true.
He stops trying to be innovative and clever. I'll just call it this.
I almost felt like that was Andy Weir. That was a author interjection right there. It's difficult naming things.
Oh, it's so hard finding new things and having to name them all the time. Yeah, my life is so hard.
Yeah.
But I'm just like,
I wish I had that hard. I wish I had that hard life. Yeah. I'm dealing with it.
Yeah. Every time they mentioned Xenonite, I was like, what are you guys doing? Awkward.
I don't know. I was trying to
console
comfort
me.
Him.
She was consoling.
My arm is in the wrong position.
If only you had five of them.
Only I had five arms.
Oh, I'm just saying.
And thinking in, what was it? Base five?
Base six.
Yeah. Yeah. That was another moment. I started hearing new math in my head. For those of you who haven't heard that, that's Tom Lehrer. Tom Lehrer, 1964. That was the year that was. Go look it up. lots and lots of fun. Cool. So.
I love all that stuff, by the way. It's like, hey, you know what? They wouldn't think in base 10. They would have all of these, elements and all of this science based on their superheated, you know, close to the sun world and stuff like
that. Yeah, with the shorter days and the shorter years.
Yeah, all of this stuff is great. All that stuff was fantastic. That wasn't any of my problem.
So the science piece peaked early and then just dragged on a little too long for you.
Maybe. Okay. Maybe that's it. I don't know. All of the problem solving stuff in the first act was great. I thought, this is interesting stuff, you know.
Okay.
So, and I don't want to sound like I hate the book, and I definitely don't feel like I'm qualified to like come down on Andy Weir for anything. You know, I was like, hey, you made a successful book. You're a successful science guy. You did all these things. I'm just some schmuck on a podcast. I don't have the right to tell you are bad or good or whatever, you know.
But
you absolutely do have the right to say your opinion in the podcast.
I was going
to
say, your opinion is valid as a consumer of his work.
Perhaps that's it. But I wish him nothing but success. You know, congratulations and keep going. You know?
Of which he has had much.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm sure this is totally going to get back to him.
They're going
to
make a movie.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Ryan Gosling is going to invite us onto this cat, onto the stage or onto the set. And he's going to look at me and he's going to say, you have a punchable face.
I thought you were going to say he was going to let you punch him in the face.
Oh, no. He'll probably punch me in the face. And I'll smile and say, please do it again, sir.
And I will record it and be the happiest I've ever been.
And let me go over to Kraftworks and just have some of the shrimp that they're going to have on the boat.
And he'll look at me and say, hi, Ken.
I'm sure.
Hi, Ken.
I'm sure he will.
Hi, Barbie.
So bad. All right. So the science piece, we've kind of beaten to death.
Yeah.
We've beaten to death. And we've
beat it like a dead Iridian.
We have different perspectives. What about, and Megan, you alluded to this relationship between Rocky and Nyland Grace.
Mm-hmm. Ryland.
Ryland. Did I say Nyland? Mm-hmm. Ryland Grace. And you say that you really enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
Were there specific moments that stood out for you that was like, this is why I love that relationship so much?
I think it's adorable that they are able to learn each other's senses of humor. Okay. And kind of tease each other. And also, like, since they are built so differently and kind of make jokes about that, there's at one point Rocky is just like, why do you have to drink so much water? Like, well, because I use a lot of water. He's like, I use a lot of water, but I don't leak all over the place. Like, I'm a cool space monster, and you're a gross, leaky space monster. And, you know, they can both laugh. And Ryan's like, well, you're not wrong.
Yeah.
That is true. That is very funny. But I also really appreciate that they recognize their own weaknesses and each other's strengths. And the way they are able to work together with that, where Rocky can build anything. He is a brilliant engineer.
Yep.
He can build absolutely anything. Grace gets to the point where he totally trusts anything that Rocky builds. Because, like, he's got it. Like, everything he has made has been incredible. So, and Rocky can come up with something very quickly, which is really cool. And then Grace is the science guy. So, like, neither of them have to worry about the other parts. They're like, I know he's going to take care of it. They have an agreement early on where anything that's cultural, that's like weird, but it's cultural. They just immediately like, okay, well, I accept it. You need me to watch you while you sleep? I will do that. I don't like it, but I will do it. You know, I would rather do this other stuff, but they know how important it is to each other and they are all each other has.
Yeah.
So they're trying to, like, they look for ways to get along and to appreciate and understand each other, which, in a situation like that, it could definitely be the other way where it's like, I have to rely on this person and I hate them. Okay. I do not like anything about them. So I appreciate that in this story, that's not what happens.
Cool.
They see each other's strengths. They're grateful and they take care of each other. I think that's really awesome. And they're fascinated by each other. They love each other.
Sure. Ken, did you have the same feeling about that?
Oh, it fell again.
I actually was reminded about... When we were talking about what we were talking about here reminded me of something we were talking about with Ryland's personality, or, you know, how he descends in. Is he supposed to be unlikable toward the end? Because there's a point in their interaction between Rocky and Grace that he's trying to tell a joke and he's trying to do this stuff. And even Rocky is getting a little annoyed at him. Like, yeah, just give me the information.
Yes.
Yeah. Just shut up and say what we're doing here. You know, and I thought, I've never sympathized with anybody more, Rocky. I just haven't.
I get that.
That's great. That's great. You're very smart. Shut up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Rocky's attitude was all of us by that point. So
yeah.
I really did like the idea of first contact being something where two beings, you know, actually try to work inside their similarities and strengths rather than immediately go to your differences and try to exert dominance and try to, you know, dominate, I guess, the other, for lack of a better term. You know, so the fact that they actually work together is fantastic and very optimistic. I mean, overall, this is a very upbeat.
It's an upbeat apocalyptic book.
Yeah, apocalyptic. Thank you. I'm like, what's the word?
We don't have enough of those.
Yeah.
A very upbeat disaster book.
So I didn't dislike the relationship. I did find it very interesting how the relationship evolved.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was well written that way. Mm-hmm. The one thing that I kept coming back to, and I came back to it more right now, Megan, as a result of you saying, we have these two very different people from two very different kinds of situations that decide that they will trust each other enough to work together to solve the problem. Mm-hmm. So, and maybe I've been watching a little too much Jon Stewart lately, but why can't we do that as people? I wonder. I'm not asking for a long conversation about why we can't. I found that to be one of the most beautiful level two conversations about this book. Mm. We can figure out how to do it with alien species. why can't we figure out how to do it with our own? And we get a couple of glimpses of that in his flashbacks, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. The initial distrust from all of the countries around the world of the research that's being done in any other place. Okay, now granted, if the United States is getting their primary information from a junior high science teacher who has been discredited by most of the scientific community that he works in, I get it. Everybody's going to be a little skeptical, right?
Right.
But then we start getting all of the other labs that start from all the other countries that start playing with, and they start picking at each other's ideas mm-hmm. and trying to one up each other. I think that whether his intent was to say, you know, we could learn a lot from this story,
right?
Because right now, whether we're talking about energy independence on the planet or global warming or any other kind of situation, all we can find a way to do is to poke holes at each other instead of build on each other's research and trust each other that we're doing the very best we can.
Yeah.
I realize I overthink level 2 and level 3 sometimes on this podcast, but I loved that piece and the way that it kind of played out in their relationships.
Well, and even they have the whole chapter where Strat is in court because everybody is suing her for copyright infringement. And she's
I
like,
I love that. The world is going to die. She's and like, we want our money.
She's like, I'm so sorry. You all are bothered. I'm trying to save the world. I actually have these papers here that say that I'm exempt. But even she acknowledges, like, once Project Hail Mary goes out there, I may be in prison for a really long time. Like, yeah. Everybody may be mad about how it went down. They may all have their very, you know, personal, oh, you should have paid me for this video game that you downloaded to your system. And
for
like,
one person
right.
that will use it in Tau Ceti.
Maybe.
Yeah, but they didn't know that. There's just three people who are going yeah. one direction.
Okay, you're right. You're right.
Coming
three
home.
People.
Well,
three people.
But I think about situations where I've had to work with people that I didn't like. And I think the reason why we make those things work is because we do actually have the goal in mind, and we make it less about our egos and our personal goals. And it's more about, no, we have this thing that we are trying to do, like doing a play. A lot of times you'll butt heads against people that you're involved with, whether it be the production team or other cast members or whatever, or like say a customer who makes a costume that I hate. I just smile and say thank you because they're doing their job and I don't know the whole picture. I'm just doing my piece.
Yeah.
And if I complain about it, then I'm the problem and it just hurts everyone and it hurts the whole project. And so poor Strat is looking at this situation going, I have this goal. Y'all keep forgetting about this. This is all I care about. And she says that to Grace at the end where she's like, I have thought about this. I was a history major. I know that all of this is about the food. And like, once you leave, even if you're successful, the planet's going to go to pot.
Mm-hmm.
Like the food is going to get scarce. Everybody's going to freak out. The people who have food are going to get like, it's going to be this whole big mess. And she's very aware of this, but she has this one goal and that is the focus. And once that's like, we never find out what happens to her. We don't find out what happens. Well, they do save the planet. Hooray. They save Earth. But like it's one of those things where, again, she's working with a lot of very unlikable people. Grace is not a likable person, but she's his number two because he's
her
like the
two.
Most likely person, but also
yeah.
is kind of similar where he's like, oh, I have this goal in mind. I'm not going to. He's like, oh, hey, turns out I was wrong about this. I accept that. Let's keep going.
Yeah.
You know, he's able to move forward and not let it be about himself. It's about the whole picture.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah,
that scene where it was all about food. Yeah. You know, everything comes down yeah. to food. Oh, that's
a punch in the gut.
That was good stuff yeah. by Andy Weir.
You yeah. know, one of the I had a friend of mine. I'm not sure that I would call him a prepper,
okay.
but he has certainly been an individual who has spent more time and I think money. Thinking through and developing contingencies
yeah.
around these situations. And one of the things that he told me one time was right now, a bucket of gold is more important than a bucket of food. And he said, but there will be a time, or he says, I foresee a time mm-hmm. when a bucket of food is worth more than a bucket of gold.
Yeah, where that turns around.
And yeah. I think, you know, there's something to be, when Strat was going through and talking about, or when Andy Weir through Strat is talking about this, this kind of Shangri-La time mm-hmm. that we are living in Western hemisphere, Western civilized society, first world, whatever you want to call it, where there is not global food uncertainty. Right. There are pockets of food uncertainty. And I recognize if somebody is listening to this in a place where there is certain significant food uncertainty, please understand I'm not trying to be disrespectful. But statistically speaking, on the globe right now, food uncertainty is at its lowest point ever. Mm-hmm. And that's largely what allows a lot of things to happen. And the picture that is painted of, oh, it's drooping down again. The picture that is painted about what happens when food uncertainty becomes widespread mm-hmm. is terrifying.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I wonder on a level two kind of a position, is Andy using this to say, yeah, maybe we should be focused a little more on that and a little less on some of the other things.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'd kind of like to meet him and ask.
Yeah. Cause even in this book, they're not like, they're not thinking for the greater good. Oh yeah, no, we're totally going to share all of our technology. They are strong-armed into it by Strat.
Yeah.
And she's very aware that, you know, yeah. once this goes out, doesn't mean everybody's going to work together.
No. in fact, if we look at history, it's a guarantee that people aren't going to work together.
Nope.
Yeah, in some ways, I think this book paints a fairly gloomy perspective mm-hmm. on people mm-hmm. And a much brighter perspective on a person working with a person.
Well, because that's how it works. Like, as a unit, we get the sense that people are a lot worse than they actually are. But when you talk to individuals, you're like, oh, people, there's hope.
Yeah.
They're really cool people in the world.
Yeah.
It's like they said in Men in Black. People are smart. No, a person is smart.
Yes.
People are dumb, panicky animals, and you know it. Yeah,
that is one of my all-time favorite movie quotes.
Yep,
person is smart.
A person is smart. People are animals.
Why don't you tell people?
A lovely human being, but
why don't you tell people? People can handle it. No, a person is smart. okay, so let me ask this question. We've talked a little about the science. We've talked a little about some of those implications. Megan, you indicated that you liked the reveal narrative mm-hmm. as he learns little bits and pieces about himself and as it goes on, all those kinds of pieces. Ken, how did you feel about that?
I liked it. I liked the flashbacks. I thought they fleshed out. It could have gotten to be a very boring book very quickly if all we were talking about is him on Tau Ceti.
Right.
You know, we needed to know why he's there, how he got there, the process of all of that. And I thought typically those flashback trope in books, it can go either way. I very much enjoyed it in this. In fact, I think I might have enjoyed the flashback sequences mm-hmm. more than I enjoyed the present action.
Because the Russians are so funny.
Because Russians are funny.
Are all Russians crazy? Yeah, they have to be. Yeah.
I read something. Somebody online had such a problem with Andy Weir's blatant racism against Russians. I'm like, oh, come on.
First, that's not racism.
Seriously.
Stop it. Ethnicism?
I don't know. Yeah. But regardless, it was a stupid argument made by a stupid person. And I don't know you and I don't care.
Wow.
I don't care. That was a dumb argument. No. Get over yourself.
Ken's opinions are not necessarily those of Legendarium and its creators.
You can read Ken at the Legendarium.
Yeah. I was more than willing to give Andy Weir earlier in this episode a large measure of grace, pun not intended. But this person who just wanted to blanket call Andy Weir a racist for making Russian stereotypes, go to hell.
Oh.
There you go.
Yeah, sometimes stereotypes work because they have some truth in them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll back up Andy Weir on that one.
I will not say that I know very many Russians. I will say that some of the Russians that I know would have gotten a kick out of the way that the Russian people were depicted.
The Russian individuals that we experienced in the book.
Yes.
Yes.
The way that those Russian people,
right.
Not the Russian people, those Russian people.
Sure.
Sure.
Megan, anything to add on that from your perspective?
No, I just really, I felt like Dimitri got most of the best lines,
mm-hmm.
which made me so happy. Every time it popped up, I went, oh, good. Yay. Because then, you know, you have like Dubois on the other hand, or Yao, and I'm like, they are
not
as entertaining, but man, they're necessary.
Dubois,
but you have to love Dubois, like, just very matter of fact. I am having a relationship with Shapiro, and you're like, oh, okay. Please stop talking about this.
Yes, we're having sex.
Let's stop talking about it.
You need to know that
now.
We're having sex. Don't you know that we're having sex? We're having sex.
And Shapiro's like, you know, he goes, Shapiro, I told him, he's like, oh, good. That's cool.
Yeah. Well, at least that's out in the open.
Awkward.
Yeah.
The only person it was awkward for was, you know, the main
was
character.
Grace.
Was the one who was not a part of the relationship.
Oh, as it kind of always is in love triangles. But that wasn't really a love triangle, was it?
No.
So with those, I found in the beginning, they made a little bit more sense as his memory was coming back. I was like, oh, okay, I get that. You've been in a coma, your brain hasn't been used, so we're starting to fire up the memory circuits. Okay, I get that.
Yeah.
Further along, it didn't make as much sense as to what was triggering him to remember things.
Sure.
And so that piece was kind of one of those where it's like, oh,
yeah.
Okay, you're remembering things and it's important for us to have this exposition. I get it. I appreciate it. It's going on.
That is a good point. Later in the book, it just felt more of an info dump than a plot device.
This is why you need to know who Dubois and Shapiro are.
Yeah.
Because Dubois and Shapiro aren't on the ship.
Right.
Right.
So why didn't we get, this is the one spot where my scientific brain, operated a little differently. And sometimes I argue with myself on this. But I would have thought that more recent memories would have been the ones that would have come back first.
Yeah.
You know, the
short term.
The indication was that the drug that was being given would not interfere with language or, large skills, crystallized skills. Mm-hmm. It would just block more recent memories. So I guess from that standpoint, the farther back the memories are, the more crystallized they've become. And so we've got an opportunity to get those. But, for me, I was kind of like, that's a very convenient plot device.
Right.
Yeah.
And it.
I don't know if I haven't looked up the information on that particular psychotropic drug as to whether or not that's really how that works. Although I'm very fascinated.
Yeah. And getting arrested in France.
Getting arrested in France now is terrifying to me. Because they said that it was the French that came up with this drug. So I'm like, I'm not traveling to France and I never want to be accused of espionage. Mm. Did you guys catch that? You didn't catch that.
I caught that. I just thought the drug was fake. I thought it was made up.
I don't know. I haven't looked it up yet. I got a few other things on my plate right now, but I kind of don't want to look that up because I do know that the NSA filters for everything.
And that's a good point.
Sure. I'm so tired of the ads that get sent to me sometimes. None like that, but you know.
Yeah, one of these days I'm going to pull one up and it's going to say, do you have problems with people in your life? Why don't you give them a psychotropic drug that will cause them to forget everything except what you want them to remember?
I do a little bit wish that I had a better idea of how much time passed for all of this. Like, was it?
Yeah.
Because it obviously took place over a course of years, but was it like 5 years or 10 years or 20? Because he's fairly young when he's sent out. He talks about that. He's like, I'm like 35. I'm like, when did it start?
And I have the body of a god.
He said it took.
Thanks, machines.
That's right. He said it took like 4 years to get to Tau Ceti, and then there's going to be some time dilation there. So he's younger now than he didn't age as fast as Earth has aged. So it's probably if he's elapsed, 3 or 4 years, then Earth is probably you know, 6-7 years, and then it takes more time to get home, and then yeah. by the time he's an old man.
But I mean, like, how what was the time difference from when they discovered the issue to when he was sent away?
Oh yeah,
like how long did it take? Did all of that?
I think one of the places they talked about it that it took about 3 years.
Oh, because that's not very long.
Because they had to, you know, you have the time spent building the rocket. You have the time getting all the materials up into orbit so they can mm-hmm. launch from there. They talked about setting up the solar farm down in Africa, making basically the entire continent of Africa one great big astrophage collector,
right?
Astrophage breeding place. All of these different kinds of things. So, you know, a period of years, but when you have fiat, when you have a tyrant that can say, no, you will do this because the planet has to survive. Go.
And they're using existing technology. She's very clear Correct. About mm-hmm. we are using technology that has already proven to work.
Yeah.
Which I just find that fascinating that, you know, she's like, what do we have that exists that we can use?
Yeah.
As opposed to trying to discover new tech, because they already have this new alien thing. They're like, that's the only new thing we want to deal with.
Yeah.
Other than that, let's use proven technology. Where it's just, I like that. I think it's interesting when people like to use the argument of the book and they're like, oh, well, it's just so convenient. They have this guy that knows all this stuff. And I'm like, okay, if we were getting it from like an English teacher's point of view who doesn't know any of this, that'd be a very different book. And also, that sounds dumb.
And there would be a lot of things that they would be inventing.
Right.
Or they would be doing a lot of homework by calling people like Andy Weir and saying, what do we do with this?
But I think that this is happening in science community and other communities that do research. And by communities, I mean like research people. I can't think of anything. But where there's a lot of technology right now that people are working on that may or may not be useful right now. But we don't know if it might be useful in the future. Like, yeah. It might be something that we need.
Yeah.
Like, say, the research that has been done on that, like, came out to be useful for certain vaccines that we've had in the last handful of years. It was like, no, this is research that we were doing. And everybody's like, oh, this came really soon. It's like, because it already existed.
Yeah.
And maybe not everybody's availing themselves of that. And that is fine. But I like that's part of the conversation where, no, this exists. People are doing this research. People are working on this. Here's this guy, Grace, who, like, you know, did not do well in the science community. So now he's just teachers are amazing. Hooray for teachers. Like, junior high school teachers, dude, this guy had some patience. But he, you know, he walked away from that and they came back and they were like, no, you're the one that knows about this. You're the person that it makes sense to talk with about this alien technology because you looked into something like this.
Yeah.
And so they made use of that. And it's kind of similar with Rocky, where it's like he was not the science guy, but he was on that ship because he was an excellent engineer.
Yeah.
And they knew that would be useful.
Yeah.
And it was.
You know, one of the things that's one of the things about this, the book that I liked, As far as the plot device of having the two different people together from the two different directions is that they needed each other to complement each other. Mm-hmm. We've talked about that, mm-hmm. right? I think that I could see a situation where the crew survived and Andy Weir didn't have the need to put decided that he didn't need to have anything. He didn't need to make any kind of comments about getting along, about any of those kinds of things. It could have been a very different book. Mm-hmm. And then I think it might not have been quite as interesting for many of us.
Right.
Because we would have been used to these different kinds of tropes and situations that would have been going on. Maybe they would have solved the problem much faster and then just killed themselves.
Right.
Because that was what they were supposed to do, right? So I think there's a very sentimental piece of this that makes it work better for a story. I'm not sure always that I felt like the connection of learning each other's language in a matter of days, weeks.
Yeah.
Was realistic.
The convenience of a laptop.
I understand that this was a process of trying to figure out simple things very quickly first. I've seen lots of representations of that in science fiction communities, lots of different properties, science fiction properties, and it's always portrayed as something that happens fairly quickly because it has to. Yep. And so that was one of the pieces where I was doing this and I was like, I'm not so sure by that.
That is one of the reasons why I like listening to the audiobook. Then I feel like I get a sense of, you know, they're playing musical notes and he's kind of doing the weird humming and stuff where I'm like,
that was kind of cool.
It sounds like it, as opposed to just reading it on the page and I'm like, and musical notes. And my brain just kind of skips over that.
Yeah. So I want to go back to something that Ken said, just as a very brief personal indulgence.
Okay.
Strat and Avasalara.
Christian Avasarala.
Did you obviously picked up on that.
Yeah.
I'd be curious to see how many of our listeners pick up on that. When this episode gets aired, I hope we get to see.
Minus quite a few F-bombs, which I'm going to admit.
Oh, my goodness.
I appreciated the lack of profanity in this book. I'm not saying I'm some prude, you know. I can't hear a dirty word and go, well, you know, or whatever. But sometimes the swearing is just unnecessary. And it was refreshing to not have it here.
I could not recommend The Expanse to my wife. I can recommend this one to my wife because my wife and I have a very different way of looking at that process. She's like, I don't want to read it. I'm like, all right, I can't read half the books I'm reading right now then. But
there were very big similarities. The strong, no nonsense, take charge. The boss, all she had to do the woman in charge, you know,
if she had a purse full of pistachios, I would have said, yeah, this is actually the same person. Cause that was just, although I don't think she was Indian. She was European.
I want to say
I thought she was
Amsterdam.
Yeah, Danish sounds right, Dutch sounds right.
Shoot, I tried to pay attention to that and then I didn't.
Yeah, I
don't remember. And honestly, I mean, it's the fact that she was a woman is not necessarily the important part because, I mean, it could have been written as a man and that's fine. It wasn't like she was deliberately trying to be the boss lady, you know. It's like, look, here's, you know. But she was a great character. She was strong, independent, woman in charge. Every time she walked into the room, you knew who was in charge.
Yeah.
You know?
It was.
And
she took exactly zero Fs from anyone, and I loved it.
Yeah.
It was the kind of thing that made me say, oh, I have an archetype for this character that is very comfortable and very familiar, and I liked that. Mm-hmm. We've touched on it. We've kind of brushed along the side, but I want to ask the question: did you agree with everything that was with if we were in this situation? Would you really want that kind of person in charge?
I mean, there's something comforting about, like, for a lazy layperson like me with having somebody in charge. I'm like, okay, well, she's going to do it. I'll just let her do it. Just take care of it. I don't, like, because, again, like, her ego wasn't there. She wasn't doing it just, you know, because I'm in charge. It was, no, this is what the goal is. Shut up and let's fix the planet. Mm-hmm. It's not about you. It's about fixing the planet. And I can respect that. I don't know. I don't necessarily, like, if I was working one-on-one with her, I could see that being real fatiguing. Mm-hmm. But if there was, I don't know. That is such a rocky line because she is a little bit of a tyrant.
Especially because,
she's a lot of a tyrant.
At the very end, we get a chance to see, and we saw pieces of it all along where she gets the United States and the Chinese military to work together and agree to reveal each other's secrets to each other. That's got to have taken some blackmail or some heavy strong arming, all these kinds of things. We go through all of these different kinds of situations where we get glimpses But Grace never is on the receiving end of her heavy-fisted approaches.
Until the end.
Until the end.
Yeah.
And then at the end.
Then it affects him.
She's right. Like, and you are the third person. No, I'm not. Yes, you are. You're a coward. And whether you like it or not, if you were a brave person, you would have volunteered. You didn't. You're a coward. But you're the only person we've got. You're the best shot that we have from a scientific standpoint. So I'm going to put you on this rocket, whether you like it or not.
And I absolutely agreed with her, except that he's a major tool.
Well, and that's the thing, you know, I think, go ahead.
Oh, well, that is the thing where they made a couple of comments a couple of times where he sits with the crew and he's the one that talks with them about how they would want to die because apparently they all like him a lot more than Strat.
Yeah.
So he apparently is like the easier to talk to, more approachable, more sympathetic person where it's not ever going to be a comfortable situation, but I'd much rather have that conversation with somebody who recognizes this is really hard. Thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate it. As opposed to being like, okay, is that what we're doing? Okay, thanks. Like, check another thing off the list. So we get a little bit of a sense that Grace is well-liked. Somehow, he doesn't really let people in and he doesn't get close with people, but he is somehow likable.
Yeah.
Or he can be. Or at least more in regards likeable. To Strat, he's much more likable than Strat.
Right. More likable than Strat.
Which,
is not saying much.
Not hard to do.
Not saying a lot.
Yeah.
I found it necessary, and I thought it was a good idea. It was a necessary idea because in a situation like that, you're going to need one person who basically exerts martial law and is now in charge, you know, who's, you know, Palpatine in the, you know, taking the Senate or
who's make it legal.
Yeah. You're going to need one person who takes over, who says now I'm in charge and martial law is enacted and this thing is done. The only, I guess it's not a problem because oftentimes those characters are written as when we get to the end of the mandate, now that person doesn't want to give up power and that person is, and now all of a sudden we're into a dictatorship and that's where the dystopian future story becomes a thing. And in this situation, she says, I'm done.
Yeah. Once
we achieved what we needed to do. Now I'm done. I'll probably go to jail. It needed to be done.
Yeah. You know, I'll see you in hell, but I did what I had to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was a really wonderful moment. Mm-hmm. We will both wind up vilified, but we will also both have statues made of us.
It might have been a little bit of a Pollyanna move on Andy Weir's part. I appreciated it.
Yeah.
Because it never gets written like that in
literature.
She's
not in charge of the world. She's not in charge of the economy. She's in charge of this project.
Yeah.
And that's it. Yeah. That's all she wants to be in charge of.
Yep.
So I know we're running out of time. I got to ask, how did you like the ending?
Like he flies the way it
off
ends?
And goes, flies off to Rocky's world and he becomes.
He eats hamburgers.
He eats me burgers.
Hamburgers.
Yeah.
Gross.
Talk about cannibalism. Yeah. You take on that one.
I was done. By the time he turned around, I was done. And honestly, I was probably done anyway because by the time he's heading home, I don't need chapters and chapters of him eating coma slurry for 4 years and then getting home and finding everything different. To me, the book just needed to end, you know, it's like, I'm heading home. I hope I did the right thing. I hope my grandchildren, you know, I'm not going to have grandchildren because I'm a loser, but I hope my seventh grade science class kids, you know, children and grandchildren speak fondly of me and stuff. Bookends. That would have been fine with me.
Yeah.
I didn't need him to turn around. I didn't need any of that. So
I a little bit did need that from him since we had established that he's a coward and he was sent kicking and screaming for him to, again, make the sacrifice play and, you know, take care of Rocky and fix everything. And then he kind of got to go back to a life that he was somewhat familiar with where really he was just there, you know, making rocks pretty and teaching students and being the smart guy. And hanging out with his one friend. And that's about all he really wanted from life anyway.
Yeah.
Like if his life had continued on the way it was going, that's all he would have ever had.
Yeah.
And he got to kind of have the happy. It wasn't on Earth, but he got to have the happy ending.
Sure. Yeah. For me, I think the one thing that I found really satisfying. And this is maybe a level three thing for me, is that he didn't want to sacrifice himself. He didn't want to do the sacrifice play for the planet of Earth because he had no significant relationships on Earth.
Yeah.
Sure.
He's willing to make the sacrifice play for Rocky because that relationship was a significant relationship. Yeah. And I think that's a really interesting lesson. I don't know. I have the feeling that Andy was probably thinking about that as he wrote that, that we will sacrifice when we have a significant investment in this process.
Well, and he also, I interrupted you, but I'm okay with that.
Wow. What if I'm not? We'll
but
talk
when
later.
He was on Earth being faced with the choice of, hey, we're going to have you go on this. He's like, no, there are other people that could do it. Like, because he knew that there, like, he felt like it didn't have to be him. But he knew when he was in space, he was the only one.
Sure. But if you remember one of the things that they had gone through, talking about all of the testing for people who had the gene that would allow them to do what needed to be done, that had the basic scientific knowledge and that had the specific scientific knowledge of the program,
sure,
they'd still set it up. He was the only one. And if they missed their launch window, so it was set up beautifully at the very beginning. You are the only person in both cases.
Yeah.
And so, you know, yes, I've been a teacher on and off for over 40 years with students in a variety of settings. I have had those kinds of relationships, and they are powerful, and they're nowhere near as powerful as the relationships that I have for my family, for my immediate family, and for those people with whom I have sacrificed already significant parts of my life. Sorry if any of my students are listening to this. It's not that I don't love you. It's just that, you know, that's a different.
They probably feel the same way about you. It's fine.
They probably do. You know, yeah. You know, Mr. Winty, Dr. Winty, thank you for, you know, helping me with this. But no, I'm not going to sacrifice myself for you.
Yeah.
Fair.
Understood. Understood. But this is really powerful for me. One of the big things that I'm going to take away from this is, from this experience, other than how delightful it was to just read all of the science stuff and feel like I was keeping up with all of it, which I don't get very often because nobody writes that way, except Andy Weir, and scientific papers, and those are really boring. But the other thing that I'm going to take away from this is that relationships, real relationships matter. And they are worth the time, the effort, and the energy that we put into them.
Agreed.
Like this relationship here.
Aww. Like the blue team.
All right. You're done.
We're not done quite yet. You never answered the question.
I know. Remind me what the question was.
Okay. What's the one video game you're playing? What's the video game you're playing first on the way home?
I don't know. It's going to have to be some kind of story game, and I don't really play those.
Megan's face is
melting. I have five.
Oh, you have five.
Just one.
I have five.
Just one. What's the one?
Just
the first
one.
Yeah, first one.
Star Wars Squadrons, because I haven't been able to play it all the way through yet because I've had so many things going on. But then immediately followed by the Star Trek simulator game that came out in 1984, the one that you sit in and you dial it, and it's still two dimensional, but you dial it and you've got the warp engines and and then moving into
Do you think that they have the articulating seat in? In the Hail Mary?
He's got Rocky. He can have Rocky design it for him before he leaves.
There you go.
You know what I'd play? Atari. I would play the original Atari Smurfs game because I love that music and it just makes me so happy. What would you play, Ken?
I
am older than you think.
Oh, my gosh.
Low five.
I honestly don't know, but it would probably be some game that drags, like some MMO that just I can plug it in and it just, you know, it never really ends, so I can keep playing it for
lots
4
of punching.
Years, lots of punching nonstop,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
Maybe Punch Out.
Okay, now we're done. Thank you for joining us. We'll see you next time.